Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I'm Brett King.
And I'm Jason Henricks. Every week since 2013, we explore the personalities, startups, innovators, and industry players driving disruption in financial services.
From incumbents to unicorns, and from cutting-edge technology to the people using it to help create a more innovative, inclusive, and healthy financial future. I'm JP Nichols, and this is Breaking Banks.
This week, JP Nichols continues his exploration of the risks and opportunities in the global economy in balancing fraud and friction, recorded live in Las Vegas at Money 2020. We'll start in Latin America with Sergio Almaguer, founder and CEO of JDU, which helps small businesses manage invoices, payables, receivables, and cross-border payments. Then, Misha Esipov from Nova Credit discusses how they're addressing the challenges of immigrants and expats getting credit in the U.S.
Well, my name is Sergio Almaguer. I'm co-founder and CEO at JDU, and we help companies automate accounts payable and accounts receivable through SaaS solutions that we distribute mainly in Mexico, but we're growing also in Latin America.
All right, well, I want to start with the name. So JDU, but yeah. Pronounced or spelled Y-A-D-O-O.
Y-A-Y-D-O-O.
Y-A-Y-D-O-O,
yeah.
Okay.
And pretty much the name is it means the pleasure of doing things, and is a combination of the expression yay, of happiness, and do, of doing. Right. So we started the company because we realized that there is a lot of things in businesses that you know, like people want to get done, but there are like some other more manual and repetitive things that no one wants to do. And when it comes about procurement or accounts payable, that is, let's say, where we started, is an activity that is needed by businesses, but in the end, like, no one wants to do it. So we're doing it for them, and that's we are Jay doing it, basically.
Great. Well, And I want to talk, you were recently acquired by Paystan, so we'll talk about that. But let's back up and talk about the JDU story. So talk about what problem you're solving and why you're pursuing that opportunity.
Okay. So we started first by helping companies manage all the different vendors that they have. The original idea was linked to the fact of having all your vendors in a single invoice, that you pay that invoice and then you pretty much, let's say, do the payout for everyone. That was the original idea. We went into that direction, like doing this kind of procurement concierge at the very beginning of the business. But then since the founding team had a lot of experience in SaaS and B2B payments, we ended up building a procurement platform that in the end is managing all the process from adding a vendor, creating a purchase request, upload workflows, until receiving or sending a purchase order and receiving an invoice, doing that reconciliation, and then doing the payment, focusing in Latin America. That's how we started. Then we continue growing because we realized that vendors actually said, hey, this solution is great, but it has one problem. We can only receive digital payments from your customers. We cannot, let's say, like send invoices to all of our different
customers.
It's a
closed loop system.
Yeah. So in the end, we realized that there was a huge opportunity to start providing value to those vendors and start enabling B2B payments and sending invoices to their customers and also doing the collections. So that's how we went into from procurement and AP to actually doing some AR activity. And that's pretty much what helped us to grow a lot. Like in 2020 is when we launched the AR side of the business. And since it was launched together with the pandemic and all the businesses were, let's say, trying to digitize activities because they were not able to go to the office and want, let's say, to have a place to have a single source of truth, for example. So it is when the company really like started growing because a lot of companies start going remote and they turn it from their Excel spreadsheet into a SaaS solution. And that's pretty much where we like realized that there was a huge opportunity for continue growing in Latin America.
So partially in Latin America because you're from Mexico. But are there unique things about Latin, and when we say Latin America, that's already huge,
yeah.
Right? You've got a lot of regions and a lot of countries and cultures in that. But other than your familiarity, is there something unique about Latin America that has been your focus?
So especially in the fact of the access to high quality digital solutions is something that is rather new, let's say for the last, I don't know, like 7-10 years, it is like this kind of revolution of a lot of digital services has started in Latin America, but it's quite new. So there is these the newer generations that are managing businesses. They're expecting these kind of experiences that are, let's say, very different to the solutions that existed before. So the status quo of Latin America until, let's say, 5 years ago was, let's say, only desktop software. So SaaS still wasn't a thing. And there's a huge opportunity of bringing all of, like, all the SaaS solutions and all the fintech solutions that you see in developed markets. They are really generating this new expectation in Latin America for Latin American businesses. So there is a huge opportunity to disrupt the market there, and specifically in the context of fintech and banks. Latin America is one of the regions where the companies have been highly underserved, where the banks have been, let's say, making a lot of margins with low quality services. And that's
why
margin
is your opportunity.
Yeah, specifically that. Yeah, so that's why there is so much things happening in fintech space in Latin America, because the opportunity for disruption is huge, and also, like, the market is ready to start using those kind of digital solutions.
So you were recently acquired by Paystand. So talk a little bit about Paystand and why they acquired JDU.
Okay. So Paystand is a B2B payment network that started, let's say, working on the account receivable side, specifically with mid-market companies, and growing a lot through the integration with ERP software. NetSuite, for example, is one of the... how can I say, main channels that they use to, or that Paystand uses to distribute the software. And the reason why there is a perfect fit between Paystand and JDU is because we pretty much have been growing from opposite sides of the story, and kind of growing into the same direction, into a point that we realize that the complementarity is just a match made in heaven, if you want to put it like that way. In the case of Paystand, they started with AR and they continue growing more into AP. They've been going to mid-sized companies, some a bit larger. On our side, we started with procurement AP. We moved into AR, mostly focusing in SMBs, us focusing in Latin America, Paystand focusing in the US, and both we were, like, already having plans to start growing into different regions. So we understand that, for example, in order to conquer Latin America, it's not that you just launch a US product into Latin America and expect it to win the market. That's something that many companies have tried and they didn't do it, because
it will continue to try and it will continue to not work.
Yeah. So pretty much when we can mix, you know, like, the understanding of the Latin American market, the needs of the Latin American market, with the technology that is built in the U.S. and all the innovation, because what is expected, let's say, from customers in the U.S. is definitely higher than what is expected in Latin America. So understanding the distribution in Latin America and bringing that technology is just a huge opportunity. But also there is a lot of capabilities that we have right now in Latin America. For example, access to an engineering workforce that is definitely less expensive than what you can find in other developed markets, that can accelerate product development, that can accelerate time to market. There is, like, a lot of opportunities to start bringing those worlds together, and pretty much bringing all the experience of the U.S. and also all the capabilities that we also have in Latin America, and make a beautiful company out of that.
Well, how did you find one another?
So actually, the half of the team of Paystand is already in Mexico. They have an office in Guadalajara, and they have an office in Sonora. So when they opened the Guadalajara office, I got invited by one of the common investors, and that's pretty much where we met. And since the very beginning, we were, like, kind of thinking about doing things together. And then as things continually were moving forward, we're having, let's say, regular updates, I don't know, like once per quarter or maybe twice a year or so. So we're, like, just, like, keeping in contact with each other until we realized that there was the right time to do it. So this is something that in the end, you know, like, it's a relationship that actually, like, started, like, more than 2 years ago. And in the end, like, the fact of knowing Jeremy, that is the founder and CEO at Paystand, that he is also half Mexican. Actually, his mother is originally from Mexico. So having, like, this kind of cultural fit is something that also helps a lot in allowing this kind of acquisition or this kind of join.
Are you working or looking outside of the Americas?
So right now the objective is to conquer the whole American continent. From the Payston side is pretty much US and growing into Canada. On our side, the focus is Spanish speaking LATAM, because Brazil, it's another whole thing. It's another
besides
monster.
Besides the language. Yeah, right? It's another whole thing.
Yeah, so that's why we're focusing in Spanish speaking LATAM, and after Mexico, Colombia is the largest and closest culturally and also in terms of needs. There is also something very interesting happening in Colombia that is similar to what happened around 10 years ago in Mexico, that is that electronic invoicing is becoming mandatory. So every company now
it's becoming
has to
mandatory
start,
yeah, by mandatory. Law.
Yeah, so that's something that already started a while ago in Mexico. So every invoice that you send in Mexico has to be, let's say, digitally stamped by the Mexican government, like the Mexican IRS, let's say, is called SAT. And that central database holds information of all the invoices of all businesses. And that's why there is also like a lot of opportunities for doing like SaaS related to that central information of electronic invoices in Mexico. That's something that also happens in Brazil. They have their own rules. Actually, both Mexico and Brazil are the two most complex electronic invoicing systems in the world. And Colombia is just moving into electronic invoicing. So that's also an opportunity for starting digitizing a lot of the activities, because if you think about it, most of the businesses don't, let's say, require by law to send electronic invoices, but now that they need to do it, they have to use some kind of software or some kind of tool to start issuing those invoices. So that's this kind of external factor that is pushing businesses to be digitized and formalized too. So that's something that is also an opportunity for all entrepreneurs to help these companies.
So Paystand has also been kind of a pioneer in blockchain and DeFi-based payments. Is that something that you had been working on prior to this, or will that be new with this acquisition?
So definitely we've been working in the sense of bringing that technology also to Latin America. We're at the very beginnings of this. And what I can say is that there is a huge opportunity, because when you think about blockchain based B2B payments, there are huge opportunities in how all the information via blockchain is more open to everyone, how the reconciliation is faster, how we can also work into other kind of DeFi solutions that allow, for example, moving money on chain and start enabling other kind of alternative financing opportunities. I see a huge opportunity for cross-border payments too, and we're just getting started on that. So what is important to say here is that while there are companies that are, let's say, building solutions directly in a specific for example, cross-border payments or something like that, what we have is the network on both sides. So we have the network of businesses both in the US and the network of businesses in LATAM. So we are starting first by digitizing the activities of how they send and receive invoices, how they pay and collect those invoices, and then we start to connect the nodes, to start building this network that is going to be based on blockchain. Because in the end, if you think about traditional rails or traditional ways that money flows between countries, is one of the largest opportunities there.
Well, especially once you start talking cross-border, right?
Yeah.
Cross-currency and all of that. Now, will that be better or worse with the regulations in Mexico and Colombia? Are they prepared for DeFi?
So specifically, when you think about how money flows locally, so of course all the regulations are going to be applied on how the money flow, let's say, inside the local financial system. And I believe that there is a lot of work to be done to start kind of pushing that in a different direction, because of course what the government is bringing and all the regulations, there are many reasons to do it. Many of them are linked to money laundering, for example. So in the end, definitely there is a good reason to try to formalize everything. But when you think about, let's say, moving money between countries, or when you think about other kind of use cases, for example, reconciliation, or start, let's say, moving money between accounts or creating closed loops. In the end, let's say, when you think about money moving on chain, in the end, money becomes software and it's just a number that is being balanced or netted, let's say, between different accounts from businesses that already do business together.
Right.
And as long as these businesses are okay moving money from one side to the other and don't want to put it inside the traditional financial system, in the end, that will work. I believe the more companies accept or use like this kind of blockchain networks, in the end, are going to enable an alternative kind of exchange or an alternative economy that doesn't have to go through the financial system, as long as businesses end up like accepting it. If they want to, let's say, pay something to a company that still is not accepting or still is not part of this network, in the end, of course, we cannot do anything with that, and we have to be part of a traditional financial system. But as long as companies accept and are, let's say, fully digitized and are okay, we can do realize all the values that we can do with a blockchain about how we reconcile payments, how we can move money with lower fees in instantly. So in the end, there's a lot of things that can be done. But the first change is not about the government; it's about companies actually transitioning into this payment networks.
Yeah, it's a bit of a future right?
And something that is interesting is when you think about how innovation has been happening in emerging markets, like speaking specifically about the case of Latin America, it is very interesting to see that many times there is this kind of leapfrog in innovation where people or companies kind of have a status quo use case or tools that they use, and then there is this new innovation that comes that kind of brings everyone 10 years in the future, similar to what happened to consumer payments in Africa, for example, that they went directly, let's say, from cash to paying with the phone, for example. I believe something like this is happening right now with B2B payments in Latin America, because the traditional way that money is flowing is so much worse than all the new solutions that we can bring. And I believe if you go and so businesses are very, how can you say, sensitive to the margins that they have to pay or the commissions that they have to pay for moving money or the interest rates of the loans that they get. So the more we can provide innovative financial services that are happening or enabled by blockchain is how we're going to be moving all those companies into this new future. And I believe that in the end, it will be more difficult for developed countries to kind of move everyone into this direction, because the status quo is not great, but it's not so bad compared to how it is in emerging markets.
That's exactly the key, right? Leapfrogging happens when there's sufficient gain over what you're doing today. Brett always talks about, why are we still carrying pieces of plastic around in our wallet? Because it isn't that bad, right? It works. We all have it. We have an infrastructure around it. If you don't have an infrastructure around it, you're going to be more willing to adapt something else. And I think business payments, I'm super fascinated with all things B2B, but payments in particular, because blockchain is maybe not an ideal solution for consumer payments, right?
Definitely.
The ability to do...
The cost of pressing in the end is something that you also have to consider.
And the speed,
and
right?
The speed.
The number of transactions. Yeah. But when we're talking about, multiple seconds versus milliseconds, but in B2B, when we're talking about
days and maybe
into months of receiving and being able to do that faster at a much lower relative cost, close to zero, it's a big difference, right?
Yeah. No. And that's why there is so many applications that in the end can really transform how businesses transact and behave, because it's not only about the rail and about the speed of doing it, but it's also the fact of when you have everything like recorded, and when you have this, there's a lot of activities that where there is people doing these manual repetitive activities that no one wants to do, but you have to do because in the end you have to reconcile everything, because you have to like understand how your taxes are going to be working, because you have to blah blah blah. So in the end, there's a lot of activities that in the end, if money is just software, that in the end can be automated and simplified.
So Paystand just made another acquisition with Oyster. Talk a little bit about what Oyster does and why that acquisition.
Yeah. So specifically, when we speak about Oyster, it's a company that was founded by Vilash Povala. Vilash was the founding CTO at Clip. Clip is one of the largest mobile payment, let's say, tools in Mexico. So think about Square, but in Mexico. So and he has a lot of payments experience. Oyster originally was founded like as a product to enable debit cards and credit cards for SMBs, and then moving more into payments specifically, like start like enabling payment links. So the reason why is relevant specifically Oyster is because when we think about all the payment links and how they are helping us digitize businesses, in the end there is a very strategic go-to-market that we can achieve thanks to Oyster, specifically when and it's a fact about enabling payment embedded payment links inside ERPs and accounting software. If you think about, let's say, all this change and transition that I was mentioning before about electronic invoicing, companies require some kind of tool that allow them to send electronic invoices, but not all electronic invoices already have, let's say, a payment link embedded. And the way to end, like to start going faster into the market and digitizing payments is one of the ways of doing it is through those electronic invoices. And if we are embedding those payment links inside the electronic invoices that are generated by the accounting software or the billing software or the ERP, is how we can reach those customers. So in the end, it's kind of a high-speed avenue to start going into that segment of the market.
And including point of sale.
Yeah, of course, yeah. So in the end, something that is important is when you think about for example, SMBs in Latin America, the large majority are not digitized, the large majority are still not processing payments, but around 20% of all the SMBs are already like digitized in the sense that they are sending electronic invoices. In order to like a way to get through them is pretty much by these payment links and making all of them merchants and start processing payments.
Great. Well, that was a lot.
Yeah.
anything I didn't ask you that you want to make sure we talk about?
So specifically about the how, like, in the end, blockchain can also like be so transformative in Latin America. I know that we like already mentioned something about it, but it's very interesting to see how there are, let's say, countries with very with financial systems that in the end are very volatile, like the case of Venezuela or El Salvador, that in the end are pretty much kind of the people themselves are kind of pushing forward and moving forward like blockchain alternatives because the traditional system is so bad. So in the end, to share to the audience like how when things are bad, in the end it's like just the opportunity of doing something great, and specifically emerging markets and Latin America for B2B payments, I'm sure is the single most important place in the world to make this transformation.
Talk for just a quick minute. You mentioned El Salvador. They made a famous big bet into Bitcoin.
Yeah.
But blockchain's a lot more than
of course.
Bitcoin. So kind of what's happened there and where do you think it goes from here in El Salvador?
So this is like still a small step for the big change that is required, because even if you make Bitcoin, let's say, a legal tender and start like making official for enabling payments, there is still like some more important transformational and social change that needs to happen to actually, let's say, make sure that everyone is going to be using that solution. So it definitely it is important that at the government level and at the regulation level, it is possible and it is enabled, but there is also like this kind of enablement in terms of providing access to all the digital solutions like to the people so that they can actually benefit from this regulation. So in the end, I'm convinced that this is something that is needed, that we have to walk into that direction, but it's only one of the ingredients of the whole transformation that requires to be done, because if in the end the people cannot actually use it because they don't have access to the digital tools or whatever, so in the end it's not going to have the impact that everyone is expecting to happen.
Great. Well, thanks for being here, Sergio.
Thank you very much.
Hello, listeners. I'm Brett King, the host of Breaking Banks. Together, myself and Dr. Richard Petty have recently released our latest best-selling book, The Rise of Techno-Socialism. We look at how inequality, artificial intelligence, and climate change are going to shape our world moving forward. During the pandemic, the wealth of the world's billionaires ballooned. The richest 1% added $1.6 trillion to their wealth, meaning that they own more wealth than the bottom 90% of Americans today. Unemployment skyrocketed during the pandemic, but artificial intelligence could disrupt up to 80% of the jobs today. These new industries we are creating will face labor shortages because we aren't training our students with the right skills. By 2050, we'll need to produce 70% more food to feed the 9 billion inhabitants of the planet, but we lost 40% of our farmland to erosion and pollution in the last 50 years. By 2050, 570 global cities face inundation from sea rise. Miami, Guangzhou, New York, Calcutta, and Shanghai are just the top five cities. If you want to know more about the solutions to these problems, check out The Rise of Techno-Socialism, our latest best-selling book. You can get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or go to riseoftechnosocialism.com to find out more. Welcome to the future.
All right. We'll start by introducing yourself.
Just jump right in.
Jump right in.
Yeah, my name is Mish Shestapov. I'm one of the co-founders of Nova Credit, and really excited to be here.
Well, glad to have you. Well, tell us about Nova Credit. I mean, what are you focused on? What problems are you solving?
Yeah, so millions of folks move to the United States every year, and when they first arrive, they need to get a place to live, open up a bank account, get a cell phone, get a credit card. They may need an auto loan or lease. There are a variety of basic financial services that they need upon arrival, but by virtue of having just arrived here, they don't have any U.S. credit history. And so when they apply for those services, they're effectively locked out of the U.S. credit system and have to struggle with being able to get those basic products unlocked. And so we've spent the better part of a decade now making it possible for folks to come here and get approved for the products they need from the moment they arrive.
So how do you do that?
So the core of what we do is called the credit passport, and effectively what we've done is we have aggregated the world's credit reporting system. So what does that mean? So though you're all probably familiar with Experian, Equifax, TransUnion, the big credit bureaus here in the U.S. They exist around the world. They have competitors around the world. And basically what we've done is we've flown around the world. We've built partnerships with the leading credit bureaus in every one of these markets. We've built data integrations into those markets. And we allow for an individual's financial identity, their credit history, to compliantly, instantly, in one standardized format, to make its way here into the United States to support a credit application here. So, for example, if you just moved to New York from London and you want to apply for, let's say, an American Express credit card, you may have no credit history here in the United States, but you would be able to use, in that case, your Equifax UK history to get instantly approved for a card once you get here in the United States.
So does that require you, in that example, having a partnership with American Express so that they're able to receive and utilize your data?
That's right. Yeah. So American Express kind of thinks of us as a global credit bureau. So the same way that they have, relationships with various data providers and credit bureaus here, we are one of those that, is really the world's only provider of cross-border credit bureau data.
So who else have you partnered with? Don't read the entire list, but give me an idea of the kinds of partners use it particularly around credit passports?
Yeah, so I mean, you can think of us a little bit as like a two-sided marketplace in a way, where on our supply side, we think about partners as credit bureaus all around the world that we're partnered with. So today we have connectivity in about 20 different countries. So India, Mexico, Canada, the UK, Australia, Nigeria, Brazil, Philippines, and a number more. And so in aggregate, we can access credit bureau data on over 1.5 billion consumers all around the world. And that connectivity allows us to serve the majority of the annual inflows of folks that are moving here, whether it be for work or for education or for family reasons. And then the other side of our market is really the distribution side. So, you know, I mentioned our relationship with American Express. Not too long ago, we had an announcement with Verizon where, you know, the credit passport is now being used to unlock devices and device financing. And you can walk into, you know, any of Verizon's 1,500 retail locations and use the capability, even if you have no financial identity here. We also recently had an exciting global announcement with HSBC, where we're taking this capability with the credit passport and deploying it all around the world in service of migrants moving to Singapore and moving to other major expat markets.
So you're embedded then in these service providers. Do you also go direct to the consumers? If I moved here from another country, do I search out Nova Credit and say, oh, now I can use this to do things I need to do? Or is it more, it's going to come up when I go to Verizon, when I go to Amex?
It's both. So we really started first by, you know, enabling some of the largest financial solutions in the world to embed our capability within their application to give this population of folks the ability to, you know, insert more information into their credit application process. And in doing so, create a more complete picture of who they are and allow a lender to make a more fair and informed lending decision. Separate from that, consumers can come directly to us. You could go on, you know, online and Google, you know, best credit card for immigrants, and we're going to be on that list. And we create a whole curriculum and content around best practices of, you know, how to build credit in America and how to accelerate and jumpstart your journey of integrating into this country. And through that, we will also, you know, recommend some of the best partners and products out there for this segment.
So I'm imagining neither side of that marketplace is easy. They're different kinds of hard. Where have you had kind of the biggest challenges and biggest successes so far?
Yeah, I wish someone told me back when we started the company that building a cross-border credit bureau, you know, would be as hard as it has been. I mean, it takes a healthy dose of naive optimism to take on this challenge. But I mean, there's a whole host of complexities and regulatory challenges and data definition challenges that you have to navigate. I mean, on the supply side, working with credit bureaus can be very complex, to put it lightly. And we work with more credit bureaus, to my knowledge, than any company in the world at this point, partnering with all of the big ones, as well as a variety of independent small players all around the world. You know, that we solved most of that problem, you know, I'd say a few years ago. And now the big challenge remains, you know, selling to banks. And for those of you who work at a bank or work at a fintech that are tuning in, it's quite hard to sell to you, you know, for a variety of reasons.
That's a whole other episode.
That's a whole episode. we could spend talking yeah, through that. But you know, it's we've been really excited and are feeling incredibly lucky that we've got a lot of tailwinds right now in the business. The macro environment is back. Immigration's back. Immigration drives the majority of U.S. population growth. So there's more folks who move to the U.S. every year than there are Americans who turn 18 and become eligible for financial services. If you look at, you know, cities like San Francisco, 30% foreign-born. L.A. and New York, almost 40 or just over 40% foreign-born. And so this is a must-have segment to be able to continue to win, to be able to grow your book of business.
Well, yeah, that whole, I mean, that is the holy grail question, right? Where's the growth going to come from? And how do you address that, right, for the traditional financial service players? So speaking of that, you've announced a partnership with HSBC. What's that look like and what's that solving?
Yeah, so big announcement for us. It's been, you know, dare I say, a couple years in the making, if not longer at this point. But the core of that relationship is we're taking this credit passport capability where we've got connections in roughly 20 different countries around the world, and we're making all of that global connectivity available to serve migrant corridors destined around the world. So if you're someone moving from India to Dubai or Nigeria to London or you know, the Philippines to Singapore, those are major immigrant corridors where the same basic problem exists, which is there is an information asymmetry. Data exists in one economy, in one market, in one data system, and doesn't exist in another. And so by being able to deploy the credit passport into these markets and more, we're able to support HSBC's customers with getting the best product they could get approved for, improving their line assignment, improving the overall value proposition of, you know, across cards, across mortgages, across personal loans, and more. And so that relationship is one we're incredibly excited about. As part of that relationship, we also took a strategic investment from HSBC. So we brought in some more capital to further accelerate our ability to deliver on an international rollout, which is not for the faint of heart.
No. You talk about the asymmetry of data across different markets and different countries. Are you or is anybody working on trying to standardize that? Or is that just always going to be your job to be the translator in the middle of everything?
I think we have taken on the duty of being that global translation layer. So to my knowledge, we're the only company that can look at a credit report from CIBIL TransUnion India and transform that and make it look and be decisioned on the same way as a Equifax UK report or an Experian Brazil report or an independent bureau from Nigeria. And I'll normalize all of that into one set of data definitions that can be used and decisioned upon in a FCRA and ECOA compliant manner here in the United States. So that's us. We are the cross-border credit bureau. We've sort of spent the better part of a decade now proving that out and you know, building a moat around that business and really getting this company off the ground. And from that base, we're starting to build out additional products like the Cash Atlas.
Well, let's come back to the Cash Atlas because I want to talk about that. But I also want to ask, what about beyond the credit bureaus and alternative data? How are you utilizing, other than, you know, the equivalent of Experian in another country, what other kind of data points are you gathering and looking at?
So we're spending a lot of time with bank transaction data. So open banking, bank transaction data, you know, the information that exists in someone's, you know, checking account, that really is the, we think an incredible, has an incredible wealth of information in it. You know, you see a change in a consumer's financial health far earlier by looking inside their bank account, by looking at it, you know, a change in their income profile, their deposit history, by looking at, you know, change in their expense profile. You know, is it recurring? Is it not? Is it trending up? Is it trending down? What's going on with their cash balance? Do they, you know, how often do they have NSFs or insufficient funds? And, you know, our view is you can get a clearer and more current picture of someone's financial health in their bank account prior to being able to do so by looking at their credit bureau. And so it was that sort of long-term view that ultimately led us to creating the Cash Atlas, which is our first big bet in the world of alternative data.
All right, well, so talk about that. What is that, and then what opportunity does that address?
Yeah, so using cash flow-based underwriting, we view is the sort of the next frontier for the credit risk space, especially for consumer underwriting. You know, we think that the bureaus have done a good job of building a great data asset and helping, you know, create visibility into a lot of consumers. But over 50 million Americans still have a fairly thin file with very limited information, which the vast majority of lenders that they may apply for don't have the sophistication or know-how for how to underwrite. And it's precisely for those that are sort of more new to credit or have limited credit histories where this product can be absolutely transformational, where by giving a consumer, whether they be an immigrant or just a regular everyday American, it's really for anyone that has a U.S. bank account, by giving them the tools to credential access into that account, by letting them log into that account, they can unlock a wealth of information that the lender can then use to create a more complete picture of who they are, and in doing so, have a better understanding of being able to say yes.
What's that journey like getting those lenders to accept that additional data? We understand how to read a credit bureau. We understand credit scores. You're bringing some new data points in here. How do you get traction around something new like that?
The same way we did with the credit passport. I mean, it's we're operating in the world of, you know, what we think we've helped coin, which is consumer permissioned credit data. And so that is the credit passport where, you know, through a consumer's express and voluntary consent, they're permissioning us to act on their behalf, unlock more data, and insert that data in a compliant manner into a decision. And the same thing is that's the same thing that we're doing with Cash Atlas, where a consumer is permissioning access for us to go and access their bank data and inserting that into a credit application. And there's a whole host of challenges that emerge in, you know, working with banks and risk teams and compliance teams and user experience teams, all challenges that we have now successfully navigated with, you know, at scale partners, some of which I've already mentioned. But maybe just like one concept to hone in on is, you know, in the credit risk world, everyone is accustomed to doing this thing called a retro study, where, you know, you're going to want to go and do a statistically significant analysis to look
back
at a back test and know with, you know, high degree of confidence of exactly how much, you know, business impact and lift you're going to see. And the very nature of consumer permissioned data is that you need the consumer to give you access to that information, and that is incongruent with the traditional ways of doing retros. And so you ultimately have to build the organizational buy-in to test your way into this kind of data source. And that's how we did it with, you know, with the credit passport and our work with American Express and some of the others. And it's through, you know, starting to get more and more comfortable with information, finding ways to do that with a more limited, you know, credit box, that you can get greater confidence in being able to unlock the true power of this kind of information.
So is this all consumers, or are you doing small business as well?
Pure consumer right now.
Yeah. Vision towards that in the future? I mean, it's a whole other animal.
Yeah.
Right? I get it.
We see a lot of opportunity on the small business side. I think, you know, as a relatively small organization, we gotta pick our battles.
And sure.
So far, we've chosen to focus our energy, our resources on solving challenges of financial access for consumers. I'd love to be in a position in, you know, a couple years time to be able to say, and next, you know, next is small business.
Sure.
But for now, we think there's an incredible amount to do just on the consumer side.
Certainly. You know, another theme that's come up in recent conversations, we can't do anything you're talking about without identity verification. How are you handling that?
Yeah, so with respect to the credit passport, we actually bump into challenges of identity all the time, because these are folks who don't have an identity here in the United States, right? When they arrive here and apply to open up a checking account, you know, the bank is going to check the U.S. bureaus, and the U.S. bureaus are going to say, we don't know who this is. Like, they don't even have a header file for identity purposes, and LexisNexis and some of the others don't know who this segment is. And so we've developed creative solutions that allow U.S. lenders to use the credit passport and check the leading identity and credit bureau database of that foreign country and rely on that information for purposes of satisfying U.S. KYC and SIP and Bank Secrecy Act type of challenges. And so that's really a core part of our innovation, where someone that has no identity here and can, you know, credential themselves in a foreign database, and for that to allow them to open up their first account here in the U.S.
Are you using any biometric data?
Not yet. No, nothing there yet. But we're really excited about that space. We've seen some really promising new entrants there, some of which we're exploring ways to partner with.
Great. Well, what else you want to make sure we talk about? You know, a lot going on in this space, and you've got a lot of things going on at Nova Credit.
I mean, it's an exciting time right now. I think the industry has talked a lot about alternative data and underwriting, and the availability of that information is just becoming more easily accessible in a more standardized manner, proven to have been successfully used in a compliant manner. And I'm just really excited to be able to continue to create great products that help people who very much need a range of financial services to be able to enter the financial system.
Great. That was good.
Okay. We'll keep it punchy there.
Great. Well, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah. Great.
That's it for another week of the world's number one fintech podcast and radio show, Breaking Banks. This episode was produced by our US-based production team, including producer Lisbeth Severance, audio engineer Kevin Hersham, with social media support from Carlo Navarra and Sylvie Johnson. If you like this episode, don't forget to tweet it out or post it on your favorite social media, or leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Google Podcasts, Facebook, or wherever it is that you listen to our show. Those actions help other people find our podcast, and in return, That helps us build an audience that can be supported by sponsorship so we can continue to provide you with our award-winning content every week. Thanks again for joining us. We'll see you on Breaking Banks next week.